KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. Last Friday, a federal judge in Phoenix denied a pair of motions seeking preliminary injunction to stop the Oak Flat land swap between the U.S. Forest Service and multinational mining company Resolution Copper. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
Federal Judge Dominic Lanza considered their pleas premature amid a nearly two-hour hearing at the Sandra Day O'Connor Courthouse. In fact, Lanza had admittedly made up his mind before plaintiffs, including the San Carlos Apache Tribe and a coalition of conservation and recreation groups, showed up in court. The judge said granting their request would subvert an act of Congress. However, Lanza also ruled that the Forest Service could not proceed with the land exchange until the 60-day mark following the government public publishing its final environmental impact statement for the proposed copper mining project. The federal agency is expected to release that report later this month. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Roughly 73 square miles of forest land in Northern California have been returned to the Yurok tribe in what's being called the largest land back conservation project in state history. Christina Onnested reports.
The land back more than doubles the Yurok tribe's ancestral land holdings, including salmon habitat and areas of cultural and spiritual significance. Tiana Williams-Clausen is the Yurok tribe's wildlife department director.
Reacquiring landscapes like this allows us to heal, to work towards healing a wound that was inflicted not only on the lands but our hearts when these lands were taken away from us.
Josh King of Western Rivers Conservancy says his organization bought and transferred the land to the tribe in phases, raising $56 million for the conservation deal.
We're thrilled to announce that we've transferred the final phase of land to the Yurok tribe and completed creation of the Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary and the Yurok Tribal Community Forest.
Historically, the Yurok tribe had fished, hunted, and gathered here. The tribe lost 90% of its territory through gold rush massacres and disease from settlers. Timber companies owned and managed the land for over a century. Tim Hayden is the Yurok Tribe's Deputy Executive Director of Natural Resources.
This is an incredible opportunity for the tribe to really assert its self-determination, manage its own resources for the benefit of both fish and wildlife, provide access for ceremonial and subsistence and gathering needs of the tribe.
Salmon and trout populations were once the third largest in the Klamath. Now with the dam removal complete, there's hope those populations will rebound. Pergish Carlson is a river guide with the Yurok.
Generations from here will really see the benefits of it, even when I'm gone or whatever. And that's what I always kind of like smile about the future generations, how good it could be even from now.
I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for National Native News in Northern California.
And on this day in 1971, federal officers removed the last few Native activists from Alcatraz. Launched November 20, 1969, the occupation of Alcatraz Island was carried out by the group Indians of All Tribes. They claimed Alcatraz was rightfully theirs through the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, and by the federal government's closing of the prison island in 1963, designating it surplus federal property. At its peak, the occupation saw roughly 400 natives and allies. Celebrities like Jane Fonda, Marlon Brando, and Jonathan Winters all visited. In the final months, power and telephone services were cut off, and a young girl fell to her death, devastating her parents and causing them to leave. Despite setbacks, many see this occupation as the launchpad of modern American Indian activism. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We're saying solar and fill in the blank, natural gas, oil, whatever. We're part of the energy solution for this country.
Alaskans in Washington, D.C. advocate for saving renewable energy tax credits. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a task force of Alaska lawmakers prepares to look for ways to improve public education.
So rather than say no to something that could be a good idea, a task force is an opportunity to study that idea with experts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
U.S. senators have been meeting behind closed doors this week to hash out their version of the giant reconciliation bill the House passed last month. Proposed cuts to Medicaid have alarmed healthcare advocates, but the sprawling legislation would impose other spending cuts and policy changes that extend into dozens of industries. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin caught up with a few of the Alaskans who went to D.C. this week to advocate for lesser-known aspects of the bill.
The U.S. Capitol complex is crawling with citizen advocates these days. A cluster of anti-hunger champions were taking a breather in a stairwell of the Cannon House office building.
We have 500 advocates on the Hill today from almost every state in the nation, and we have 200 Hill meetings.
Sherry Andes of Massachusetts is with Bread for the World, just one of the groups meeting with Congress members and more often their staff, asking that they ditch the reconciliation bill or make big changes to it. Add to this mix Chase Christie from an Anchorage-based company called Alaska Solar, and Josh Kraft, an energy consultant and project manager from Wasilla. They're advocating to keep renewable energy tax credits. They had an appointment with Alaska Congressman Nick Begich's office and were trying to find their way to room 153.
We got to go down. We're on the second floor.
Begich is a freshman Republican. He voted for the reconciliation bill and with it the cancellation of renewable energy credits that have boosted Christie and Kraft's industry. They say the credits have added hundreds of jobs and millions of investor dollars to Alaska. Christie says renewable energy shouldn't be caught in partisan politics.
Nobody from our contingency is saying solar only. We're saying solar and fill in the blank, natural gas, oil, whatever, we're part of the energy solution for this country.
At stake are several kinds of tax credits. Some help homeowners install solar panels, heat pumps, and the like. Thousands of Alaskans have claimed them. Other credits give utilities incentives to install large-scale solar or wind generation. And utilities could sell their credits to investors. Kraft says together they've made for an effective financing tool.
You can't go to a bank and ask them for $500 million to do a wind project because they don't have the underwriting capability. The banks don't have the programs in place. So the investment firms are the ones that have stepped up and provided the capital for local folks to go out and build these projects.
Because they get the
credits. Yes, because they get the credits.
Eliminating the producer and investment tax credits would save about $200 billion over 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office estimates they've increased private investment in the renewables industry by about 30%. After meeting with a Begich staffer, Christie was optimistic that he had conveyed that the clean energy tax credits are about jobs and the economy, not politics. Another Alaskan on Capitol Hill advocating against the reconciliation bill is Lori Wolf, president of the 4-Acre Group. That's a nonprofit that supports other Alaska nonprofits. Wolf is focused on tax provisions in the bill that she says would suppress charitable contributions and philanthropy.
We're really trying to talk about the increased rate on net investments for private foundations, the limitation on itemized deductions, the business, unrelated business.
And Wolf is among many Alaskans asking the congressional delegation not to impose cuts on Medicaid.
Every rural, every urban healthcare system in Alaska relies on that, the equation of Medicaid, and you can't take that equation out and expect there to be healthcare for all Alaskans.
Republican leaders in Congress had hoped to pass the reconciliation bill by July 4, but Republican senators have been slow to reach agreement among themselves about the bill, projected to add $3 trillion to the deficit. Reporting from Capitol Hill, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A group of state lawmakers is set to meet this summer and fall to continue working on ways to improve Alaska's public schools. Lawmakers passed a bill last month boosting the base of the state's school funding formula by $700 per student after overriding Governor Mike Dunleavy's veto. The bill also made a variety of education policy changes aimed at boosting student performance. But Senator Jesse Keel, a Juneau Democrat and one of the six lawmakers appointed to the task force, says their work is not done.
This is one of the biggest expenses that state government has in Alaska. It's really important to do the best we possibly can for our kids, and also always to do the best we can with the public dollar.
The task force created by the school funding bill has a sprawling mandate. The law tasks the group with analyzing state education funding, student achievement, accountability measures, health insurance, student absences, school maintenance, and more. Lawmakers included the task force in the bill in an effort to win bipartisan support from lawmakers and unsuccessfully from Dunleavy. One co-chair, Sitka Independent Representative Rebecca Himshut, says it will give lawmakers a chance to look at some ideas like Dunleavy's proposal for inter-district open enrollment without a fast-approaching deadline.
We needed to bring folks along who had ideas that are definitely worthy of a look but were too big to take on in the legislative session. So rather than say no to something that could be a good idea, a task force is an opportunity to study that idea with experts over time and give it a more thorough vetting.
One of the two minority Republicans on the task force, Soldotna Representative Justin Ruffridge, says he's hoping to hear a wide variety of perspectives during the task force's 2 years of meetings. He wants to hear experts, government officials, and teachers explain why Alaska's public school system languishes near the bottom of national rankings.
I think some of that is due to, you know, reduced funding over the course of the last decade or so. But at the same time, it can't just be, you know, a money-only solution. I think you have to start looking at some of the reasons why Alaska is struggling to keep up with other states.
The legislature's task force announcement comes as Dunleavy weighs whether to reduce education formula funding in the state budget. He said in Fairbanks yesterday that he's planning to release his line item vetoes this week. The task force is scheduled to convene in August and meet once a month during the legislative off-season. It's required to produce a report with its recommendations by early 2027. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kachemak Bay cold plungers extol the benefits of swimming in frigid water.
It teaches you that you are strong, that you can do a lot of things. Over and over again, it just keeps kind of pushing that message home.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailers to remove plants, animals, and mud, drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Denali saw its second death of this year's climbing season yesterday after a skier was caught in a high-altitude avalanche. Park officials say 29-year-old Nicholas Vizzini was descending with a snowboarder down the mountain's west buttress route. At about 6:15 p.m. Tuesday, they triggered an avalanche that swept him up and ran about 1,500 feet. Two nearby rangers responded almost immediately and located Vizzini's avalanche beacon. They uncovered him and provided CPR for 40 minutes, but he had suffered traumatic injuries and died. Vizzini's body was sent to the state medical examiner's office, according to park officials. The snowboarder suffered minor injuries and was being flown from the mountain today. Vizzini's death comes about a week after 41-year-old climber Alex Chu was killed in a 3,000-foot fall on the west buttress. Park officials say both men were from Washington. About 500 climbers are currently on Denali, with the climbing season expected to end early next month. The mountain was recently renamed Mount McKinley by President Trump. A Korean F-16 fighter plane crashed on takeoff from Eielson Air Force Base late yesterday afternoon. The air crew ejected and were taken to the hospital. KUAC's Robin reports.
An F-16 Fighting Falcon from the Republic of Korea Air Force crashed on the runway at Eielson Air Force Base Tuesday around 4 p.m. Captain Faith Hirschman, Chief of Public Affairs for the 354th Fighter Wing, said the plane had just left the ground surface when it fell and crashed, nose down on the runway.
It's not really clear if it left the ground for a second or two. It wasn't in the air and then crashed back down. It basically skidded off the pavement.
Two pilots ejected and were picked up by emergency crews.
They were taken to Bassett to be evaluated. I think they have very minimal injuries and they're already released.
Bassett Army Community Hospital is a few miles away on Fort Wainwright. Korean media also reported both pilots were uninjured. The F-16D burned on the runway inside the fence line of the Air Force base. A plume of black smoke was visible from neighborhoods near the base. Emergency crews responded to the crash and put out the fire. Photos on social media show the plane nose down on the pavement. Officials are still assessing the extent of the damage and still investigating the cause of the crash. The fighter jet was damaged while preparing for the multinational Red Flag training exercise, which officially starts Thursday. It involves about 1,500 service members from the U.S., Republic of Korea, and Japan. They're expected to fly, maintain, and support more than 70 aircraft during this iteration of the exercise. Most will operate from Eielson Air Force Base and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage. This is the second crash at Eielson this year. 6 months ago, a U.S. fighter plane, an F-35, crashed after the pilot ejected and parachuted to safety. In that crash, the pilot reported a malfunction. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Officials with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute and Alaska Aerospace Corporation announced a wide-ranging agreement yesterday to tap into the growing market for rocket launches from the state's two launch facilities. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Geophysical Institute Director Bob McCoy told a couple dozen people in an outdoor ceremony on the UAF West Ridge that the agreement will establish a closer relationship between the Institute and Alaska Aerospace, and it'll increase the number of rocket launches at UAF's Poker Flat Research Range north of Fairbanks and the Pacific Spaceport Complex on Kodiak Island.
So this partnership is going to be outstanding. It's going to allow a higher tempo of launches and ultimately orbital launches from Poker and from Kodiak.
Alaska Aerospace President and CEO John Oberst also praised the agreement that's spelled out in a memorandum of understanding that he and McCoy signed. He said the agreement will benefit both of Alaska's spaceports and those in the lower 48, where a high demand for launch facilities have created a backlog and long delays for customers.
We have a history, both at the UAFGI and Alaska Aerospace, of decades of successful launch, both suborbital and orbital. We got the right mix for the needs of the country, and the country right now is demanding more access to space, and we can provide it. We can do it for science, we can do it for government launch, and we can do it for commercial launch.
Poker Flats launch facility is designed for suborbital launches that usually involve research payloads that aren't designed to be put into orbit. But Oberst said in an interview that the agreement will enable Alaska Aerospace to share personnel and their expertise to facilitate orbital launches from Poker Flat and more research missions from the Kodiak spaceport.
We can give our mutual customer an option now. They can launch up here or they can launch down at Kodiak.
A Geophysical Institute news release says the agreement will enable it and Alaska Aerospace to jointly develop and provide spaceport services to the booming commercial rocket and satellite industry. Oberst said customers may welcome Alaska's expanded spaceports rather than endure long waits for a launch at the nation's busiest facilities like Cape Canaveral in Florida and Vandenberg Space Force Base in California.
There is a traffic jam. What that means is there's more requirements to access space than there ever has been before. A lot of that is going to the what's called super heavy and heavy lift, which is the Falcon 9s, the Starship when it comes online, and the other large rockets that NASA procures.
Oberst says that's why smaller companies are already attracted to Alaska's launch facilities.
The smaller guys, they're not throwing up hundreds of satellites at a time. They're throwing up one or two. They need some place to go where they can actually launch. And so they're looking at Alaska for that.
McCoy says public and private sector customers that want to launch science and research-related payloads also likely will be attracted to Alaska's spaceports. The Geophysical Institute owns Poker Flat and operates it under a contract with NASA.
And so this partnership should allow more launches, lower the cost, which is a barrier. It's expensive to get to space. And so we're hoping that this will allow us to do more science.
He said that development at both spaceports likely won't cost the state or Alaska Aerospace much money because most of that cost will be paid for by their customers. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Anchorage Assembly has reversed course and will no longer require that restaurants and bars check every customer's ID before selling them alcohol. The change approved last night comes roughly 6 months after the Assembly unanimously adopted the rules and about 3 months after they took effect. Supporters of the mandatory ID checks had said the goal was to prevent minors from buying alcohol, as well as those who've been issued a restrictive red stripe driver's license due to a court order, usually related to alcohol offenses. East Anchorage Assembly member Yarrow Silvers, who wasn't on the body when the rule change passed, proposed the repeal. She says the mandatory ID check doesn't get rid of certain loopholes, and there are laws in place to make sure restaurants don't sell alcohol to those who can't legally buy it.
There's training to ensure that the laws are followed, as well as the consequences of losing a liquor license if an establishment does not follow the laws. Checking the ID of a senior citizen before you serve them alcohol is not going to prevent a minor from drinking.
Assembly members said they heard concerns from restaurants that some customers were harassing staff members over having to provide their ID. South Anchorage Assembly member Zach Johnson said the city should not change policy to accommodate bad actors. He also said he didn't think enough time had passed to see if the changes had any impact.
It's only been in place for a couple months, so I don't think anyone has any real data to point to whether or not this has had public safety benefits or if it has actually had measurable harm on the industry.
The repeal passed by a vote of 8-4. Under the ordinance, liquor stores are still required to check customer IDs for all alcohol purchases.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Un-Alaska residents are losing immediate access to air ambulance services for at least the next few months. Acting City Manager Margie Veeder announced at a city council meeting last night that LifeMed Alaska is temporarily closing its Dutch Harbor base.
We've learned that LifeMed plans to relocate their Dutch Harbor crew to Anchorage on a trial basis, anticipated to be about 3 months.
LifeMed provides emergency medical services and medevac access to Unalaska, which is roughly 800 air miles and at least about a two-hour flight from the nearest hospital. The city is home to about 4,500 year-round residents. That number doubles during peak fishing seasons. Having a base in Unalaska also allows LifeMed to quickly service several other Aleutian communities. However, LifeMed and other organizations like the U.S. Coast Guard will continue offering dispatch emergency air services from off-island bases. And Veeder says it could be worse.
So not great news, but it's also not the end of the world. They'll be dispatched out of Anchorage.
The island still has a local health clinic that offers emergency services along with the city's EMS and first responders. Dawn Johnson is the CEO of the island's main clinic. She says they're prepared to provide the same care as always.
The main thing that it does for the clinic is just increases the time that the staff will be with patients and caring for patients and increase that time, hours that they're spending there.
She says they'll be keeping track of how the change affects clinic staffing and adjust as needed. LifeMed officials did not respond to several requests for comment by the time of this broadcast. The federal agencies issuing key permits and approvals for the Donlin Gold Mine in southwest Alaska need to reevaluate the potential for a large spill of mine waste, according to a federal judge's decision Tuesday in an ongoing lawsuit. But as KYUK's Sage Smiley reports, the judge did not throw out the permits and approvals entirely.
Bethel's tribal government and five other tribes from the Kuskokwim Delta sued the federal government in 2023, arguing the environmental underpinning of Donlin Gold's permits was faulty. In her initial decision in the case last September, U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason rejected some of the tribe's claims, but Gleason agreed that federal agencies hadn't fully considered the potential that a dam to hold mining waste, called a tailings dam, could fail. A tailings dam failure could send hundreds of thousands of gallons of toxic waste into Crooked Creek and the nearby Kuskokwim River, endangering fish and animals in the area and impacting livelihoods and subsistence activities. The federal agencies considered a 0.5% spill from the tailings dam in their initial analysis, when recent failures of tailings dams elsewhere in the world have discharged much more than that. The tribes, federal defendants, and interveners, including the state of Alaska and regional Alaska Native Corporation Chilista, were then tasked with presenting solutions. The tribes, represented by environmental law organization Earth Justice, argued the court should strike down the mine's water permit, a right-of-way for a proposed gas pipeline that would power the mine, and a joint approval for the project issued by the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Land Management. Lawyers for the federal agencies and interveners argued for a less drastic approach, which would allow reevaluation of the mine spill potential without vacating the existing permits and agreements. In her final decision issued Tuesday, Judge Gleason agreed with the feds. She wrote she did not find that the error was a fundamental flaw significant enough to warrant vacating the permits. Gleason also noted the defendant's argument that vacating the permits could cause significant regulatory confusion and potential economic loss. Gleason wrote she expects the agencies to take the requisite hard look at their environmental analysis as they reevaluate and consider a larger tailings dam spill. The Army Corps and Bureau of Land Management will have to provide updates to the court every 6 months, but there isn't a deadline for when the new environmental analysis has to be finished. And if there's any construction on the gas pipeline or under the mine's water permit, they'll have to provide 90 days' notice to the court and tribes. In Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
Across the world, dedicated cold plungers fill their bathtubs with ice and water and immerse themselves. Many do it for supposed health benefits, and some Alaskans have taken this practice to the wild. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra joined one group on a recent dip in Kachemak Bay on a windy June evening.
A group of people gather on a sandy beach on the Homer Spit, which juts out into the Kachemak Bay. Cammie Mattson, who founded the group, gathers everyone to psych themselves up. They hold hands and wade into the waves, which are 46 degrees today. Mattson has been running the weekly event for about 3 years.
I'm obsessed with cold plunging.
Lately, there are about 20 regulars, some of whom stick to the warmer months. Mattson says the first couple minutes of a cold plunge are the hardest, like a cold shock. But then she says plungers settle into the cold. People stay in for a few minutes total.
Everyone who's in the water is kind of all in the same place emotionally, which is a very calm, peaceful, centered place of gratitude and joy.
Mattson started plunging 3 years ago and found it fun and exhilarating. And she says it's helped her mental health.
I used to feel like this anxiety or like the tensions of my week were building, and then I would be looking forward to cold plunging because it felt like a big reset button, and I knew I would always feel good after I had done it.
After incorporating a regular cold dip practice, she says she feels less anxious in her day-to-day life. Cold plunging is popular across the United States. Many use the practice to achieve a wide array of health benefits, from sports recovery to stress reduction. But research doesn't clearly demonstrate that cold water immersion is helpful for athletes. Some studies do show that the practice helps people feel good mentally and may decrease stress hormones. But experts say there's not enough research yet to be certain, and the practice comes with significant risks, too. Dr. Blaine Norton is an emergency department physician at Alaska Regional Hospital. He says he thinks people are plunging in water that's too cold.
When you do go into really cold water, you can lower your core body temperature. You can develop hypothermia, which can lead to confusion.
If people do cold dip, he suggests staying in water with a temperature range of about 40 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, temperatures that have been studied in sports medicine. He also says anyone with heart or circulation problems should talk to a healthcare provider before jumping into cold water. And he urges people not to cold dip alone in case they become hypothermic.
When you jump into water, you have a gasp response, particularly if it's cold. You can imagine if you have a rapid gasp of air and you're underwater, that's not going to be a good thing. So that actually leads to a lot of drownings.
He says it's important to make a plan in case something goes wrong and to set up a way to warm up quickly after getting out. Jennifer Gibson is a therapist and one of the cold plunge regulars. She says she plunges because it's empowering and strengthens her community. She says she knows she has to be careful in cold water. After one of her plunges, she said it took her hours to warm up.
Note to self, listen to my body. You don't need to push. You don't need to try and do more. Like, it's okay to just get out when it feels right to get out.
Gibson says as long as she listens to her body, she's experienced many wonderful things from cold plunging. She says one of the best parts is that it's easy to look at cold water and feel like you can't go in.
It teaches you that you are strong, that you can do a lot of things. And it really, over and over again, it just keeps kind of pushing that message home.
Gibson says it's really valuable for people to experience pushing through discomfort and to learn that we can tolerate things we're afraid of and be okay or even great. Back in Kachemak Bay, after a few minutes of splashing, talking, and huddling, the cold plungers walk out of the water. Mattson is one of the last to come to shore. She dries off and wraps herself in a towel.
I always feel just like a sense of peace as well as like exhilaration. I also feel invincible.
Then she steps away from the group and gazes out at the water and takes a few deep breaths. In Homer, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Chris Clint and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Robin and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Sage Smiley in Bethel, and Rachel Cassandra out there on the Homer Spit. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
I wait for my train to come to take me somewhere just outside of Boston. As I run to find the other sun, and I'm leaving more behind than I care to talk about. Just more pain than this heart and hands could use. As this big world's always spinning, all that I thought I was winning, I never thought I'd lose. Great force, it takes me to the ferry, to cross wind and water so untamed. And I'm on that ship, my life just seems so very small in comparison to everything around. But there's this girl over there, she's got mahogany hair and her eyes of sweet amethyst. I bow as she curtsies, doesn't look like she's gonna hurt me, so I decide to add her to my list. And she said, and she said, won't you stay on the vineyard for the summer? Won't you stay on the vineyard for the year? We'll find a little house down there, no gloves, and our children is all that we'll hear. That one day turned into five or six. Although I'm loving all the beautiful things she's showing, I back up and I'm enveloped by the mist. That girl over there, she's got my mahogany hair and her eyes of sweet amethyst. I think that maybe it would be better if I just wrote her a letter, but instead she grabs me and we kiss. Said, you ain't going nowhere. Won't you stay on the vineyard for the summer? Won't you stay on the vineyard for the year? We'll find a little house down there, no gloves, and our children is all that we stay on the vineyard for the summer. Down there are no gloves, and our children is all that we hear. And she said, stay.
It's just a ride, no need to ride.
So live it, just gotta go with it. Cause it's right, never gonna stop.
Still, I know you just don't care.
Of course I was there, then I dig my way home. If by digging I could steal the wind from the sails of the greedy men who rule the world, still you're my best friend. And after a good, good drunk, you and me wake up and make love. After a deep sleep where I was dreaming, dreaming of a dream girl, a dream girl, a dream girl, a dream girl. I was feeling like a creep as I watched you asleep face down in the grass in the park in the middle of a hot afternoon. Your top was untied and I thought how nice it'd be to follow the sweat down your spine. You're like my best friend. Oh, after a good, good drunk, you and me will wake up and make love. After a deep sleep where I was dreaming, I was dreaming of a dream girl, dream girl, dream girl, dream girl. Not to be real. Caught by a wave, my back to the ocean, it knocks me off my feet, and just as I find my footing, here you
When I first saw you, I already knew there was something inside of you, something I thought that I would never find. Angel of mine, I look at you looking at me. Now I know why they say the best things are free. Nothing means more to me than what we share.